Welcome to Bicom's Weekly Podcast. This is James Serene, Bicom CEO. This is episode 97 of Bicom's podcast, brought to you in the time of coronavirus pandemic. I excuse listeners if I have a bit of a throat or I break into a cough. I've been suffering a bit with the virus over the last week, but I'm on the mend, if you were wondering. I'm delighted to be joined by Anshul Pfeffer from Jerusalem. Anshul, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, James.
First of all, I wanted really to get into some of the detail about the big story that, with everything else going on, people have not necessarily immersed themselves into too much. But there was this spectacular reversal by Benny Gantz, the leader of the Blue and White Party, who looks like he's about to do a deal with Bibi Netanyahu, enter into government with him. And has he completely lost his reputation in terms of what he intended to do in Israeli politics? How do you see it?
Thursday evening in Jerusalem, we already left Gantz's what was to most people a surprising reversal last Thursday, when he suddenly announced in the afternoon, when the entire political scene was, the entire political establishment was preparing for the elevation of the election of Meir Cohen, a member of Blue and White, as the new Knesset speaker. Suddenly, Benny Gantz, Blue and White, or was Blue and White's candidate to be Prime Minister, put his own name forward to become the new Knesset Speaker. And it was a signal to Netanyahu that he's basically willing to talk business and to seriously engage with the deal that Netanyahu had been proposing to him for a few days or weeks before that. And by becoming Speaker, he was basically occupying that role temporarily to... So there wouldn't be one of the members of his party who is resolutely opposed to joining Netanyahu. And with that happening, Blue and White promptly split between those who supported Gantz's move to go into coalition with Netanyahu. Their reason was that because of the coronavirus crisis, there's a need for a national emergency government, and that the deal that being proposed would allow them to safeguard democracy and ensure that the rule of law would be upheld, even though Netanyahu would remain Prime Minister. And obviously those who said that, you know, we promised the voters that we would do everything to try to replace his government, and how can we be breaking the most fundamental promise we made to our voters? And that was the dividing line. Almost literally 50-50, half-half of the members of Blue and White. And for a week now, that's been the situation. Gantz has been Gantz, as he is now temporarily, has been negotiating the final details of the deal with Netanyahu. There's been a bit of a problem with Netanyahu himself, going in and out and back in again into quarantine over the last few days because of being in close contact with aides and ministers who have the virus. But as we speak now, both sides are anticipating that the deal could be signed as early as tomorrow, and perhaps the new cabinet presented and confirmed in the Knesset before Seder night. That's looking quite likely right now.
And do you think that Gantz's political career is basically over now? I mean, you know, does he have any credibility left, do you think, with the Israeli public? Or do you think they're sympathetic that, you know, he didn't really have any choice, and, you know, sympathetic with his argument that this was an emergency and he didn't really have a choice?
Well, the Israeli public, as we've seen in three consecutive elections over the last 12 months, is split down the middle. Certainly, the 51% of Israelis who voted for parties opposed to Netanyahu in the election, which was less than a month, exactly a month ago, they feel let down by Gantz, at least most of them. Some of them may have agreed with his move, but certainly a very, very large chunk of what was the opposition to Netanyahu feels extremely let down by Gantz. His own former party co-leaders, Yair Lapid and Moshe Yalon, accused him of, literally said he's crawling to Netanyahu, so they certainly have a very dim view of him right now. But we have seen in the polls, in the way we've seen in other countries, including in the UK, that this crisis, at least in its initial stages, has had a rallying around the, has caused a rallying around the flag effect, in which whoever's in charge, whether it's Netanyahu here or Boris Johnson in Britain, does have increasing popularity at this point, even if the handling of the crisis leaves somewhat to be desired. Still, there is a feeling amongst a large part of the public that this is a time not to change the leadership and to rally around. And at least some of Gantz's voters, the blue and white voters, do seem to think that. Certainly the polls that have been conducted in the last few days and last couple of weeks indicate that. So, yes, Gantz has lost credibility with the opposition. But he does, you know, his move does have a large, does have the support both of Netanyahu and the other coalition voters, and of some of his own original voters. And it all depends really on how the crisis pans out, and whether or not Netanyahu leaves office in 18 months, because the deal is that Gantz will become prime minister it will replace Netanyahu as prime minister 18 months after this government is inaugurated, for another 18 months of his own. So Gantz, you know, certainly doesn't look a very strong figure now after breaking his election promise, but who knows, this could work out somehow in his favour in the long term, especially if the rallying around the flag effect dissipates and Netanyahu starts being blamed by a large part of the Israeli public for not having handled the crisis very well.
Right. But the one question I was also going to ask is whether this very large coalition, potentially with 78 members of Knesset, more than 30 government ministers, is kind of going to have etched into its own sort of coalition deal the seeds of its own destruction. I mean, is it going to just be too unwieldy? Are the tensions between blue and white and some of the more right-wing elements of the coalition just going to be too much? I mean, already the Israeli media was saying that there's a big sticking point about one part of this coalition that wants to very quickly apply Israeli sovereignty to Israeli settlements, whereas Gantz's blue and white party perhaps doesn't want to do that, and that's going to be a big source of tension in the weeks ahead, that he wants to focus on coronavirus, that some other parts of the coalition want to do very politically sensitive, ideological, but absolutely not at all urgent things, and then that's going to be a real source of tension.
Well, those tensions, as you say, inbuilt. The deal whereby Gantz and whoever comes along with him from blue and white and perhaps from other parts of the opposition, we think that probably Amir Peres, the Labour leader, and at least one more Labour MK will be joining along with him. They are to get half of the seats in cabinet. So they will have at the most probably maybe 20 seats of their own, and there are already there are 58 MKs as a block. So half of the seats in cabinet, half the ministries are going to 20 people, and the other half going to 58 people. So that's already quite an unwieldy situation. And yeah, you mentioned the more right-wing elements of the coalition not liking the fact that this government, according to the agreement, will not immediately rush to annex parts of the West Bank under the Trump's deal of the century, that it seems so long ago now that deal was announced. But they don't want to give up what they see as a historical opportunity, and Donald Trump may well lose his bid for re-election in coming November. So they think we mustn't lose that, and that is an inbuilt tension. At the same time, I wouldn't be that surprised if, we're talking about one party, about Yamina. I wouldn't be surprised if Netanyahu is quite happy for them not to be part of the government. We know of the new government. We know that he has a very, very, very dysfunctional relationship with Naftali Bennett, who is currently the Yamina leader, who is currently his minister. We're seeing that in both Netanyahu and Bennett seem to have very different policies on dealing with the coronavirus crisis, and almost every proposal and an idea that Bennett puts forward, and Bennett, as defense minister, has at his call huge resources of the IDF and other parts of the defense establishment, and we're seeing Netanyahu basically disregarding him. He's never in Netanyahu's briefings. he has his own, you know, he holds his own briefing. So we're seeing this really, really bad relationship. Bennett will certainly not remain defence minister because that will go either to Benny Gantz or to Gabi Ashkenazi, the other senior leader of Blue and White, coming in with him to the coalition. So Yamina are also worried that they're going to lose at least two of the three key ministries that they currently hold under the new agreement. And they're worried that the government will not be as right-wing as they want. And I think for Netanyahu, having the six members of Yamina outside the coalition, I don't think he'll lose much sleep over that.
So that will actually be a really interesting indication. And it puts, I suppose, Netanyahu and Likud in a more comfortable position that they're potentially sort of the most right-wing part of this big coalition. That there won't really be anyone on his right flank pressuring him to do things that he's maybe less comfortable doing.
There are a whole load of both political and personal considerations here for Netanyahu. I mean, having a more right, ideally, he likes to have one party to his right and one party to his left in a coalition, but I think the level of animosity he currently has with Bennett and the fact that Yamina, which is currently a very small party in the Knesset, with only six MKs, are going to inevitably lose probably two out of the three quite senior portfolios that they currently have in cabinet, will also be very difficult for Bennett to swallow. I think I wouldn't put it past Netanyahu to decide that he'd rather have Bennett and his small band outside of the country. He doesn't need them when he has Gantz's seat, and of course he's retaining in the coalition his ultra orthodox allies.
Just another thing around sort of a narrative that I thought would be interesting is that Gantz has talked a lot about wanting to go into coalition to heal the divisions in Israeli society. He talked a lot on his campaigns about that, about Netanyahu's corruption. I mean, now he's in this government. Is there going to be space for him actually to keep trying to make that argument, to keep trying to talk about the rule of law and protecting the independence of the judiciary and healing divisions? Is he going to be able to do that and somehow force Netanyahu to change his own rhetoric? Or do you think that that's just a lost cause and that's really going to go nowhere? No one's going to change Netanyahu and the way he campaigns and the way he does his politics.
Well, a key element of the deal is that the Justice Ministry goes to one of Gantz's people in Blue and White. And that certainly is something that he and his allies have been talking up, that you see we're going to control the Justice Ministry, we're going to ensure that nobody erodes the rule of law and any senior appointment within the legal establishment will control, and so on. And the most important thing, Netanyahu will not be able to avoid going on trial once the full functioning court system is back online. Right now it's planned towards the end of May. That's what Gantz is going to do. That's the story that Gantz is telling. Like you said, that's Gantz's narrative. Will Gantz be strong enough to actually hold Netanyahu to those promises and to ensure that Netanyahu does go on trial? Nobody can answer that for now. It's much too early to say. It will be a very interesting situation whereby the Prime Minister will finally go on trial while remaining Prime Minister. And as you said, the man who's constantly saying, you know, we have to uphold the rule of law, will be supporting him in government while at the same time supporting him or in favour of him going on trial. So that's it's quite a bizarre contradictory situation which we may or may not have in 7 or 8 weeks from now, but that is certainly what Gantz is saying. Yes,
ultimately Netanyahu's won, hasn't he? I mean, he just showed that, you know, you stick at it, you fight hard enough, you want it more than the other guy. Three elections later, he's won. He's still Prime Minister, and he will be for a considerable period of time longer, and it's quite foreseeable that, you know, he just may not hand over in 18 months' time. He may just, you know, dismantle that coalition and go to another election.
Well, as we've said before on this podcast, in an Israeli election, you don't win on election night. When you finally swear in your new government and then go for the portrait at the president's house. So this time it's not going to be any group portrait because of social distancing. But the day that Netanyahu swears in his new government, and he's been a prime minister of a caretaker government for 15 months now, if it does indeed happen next week, then yes, he will finally be able to say that he won this very long three-election campaign over 15 months. And, you know, he won, as you said, by sticking at it. And Benny Gantz, who had some kind of perhaps opportunity to unseat Netanyahu in the recent weeks, is just can't stick at it. He doesn't have that kind of power. He's, this very long mud fight, this really toxic smear campaign that was orchestrated by Netanyahu that he's faced over the last 14 months. It's just been too much for him. And he's also, he's not a real politician in the sense that he enjoys the campaigning. He said in private that this has been the worst year of his life. You know, this is a man who had a very long career in combat units in the military. He went all the way to the top of the IDF. And yet the worst year of his life was this year in politics, not any year of fighting or battles or casualties in the IDF. And this is the kind of guy he is. He is a patriot in the sense that he doesn't think that Israel should have to go through another of these really polarizing election campaigns. And he's tired. He wants to end this long period of campaigning. Yeah. Netanyahu is a full-time campaigner. He's a man who the morning after an election gets up and starts campaigning again for the next election. That's always been the kind of politician he is. And he could go on for a fourth and a fifth and a sixth election if necessary. Everyone else is just too tired.
Yeah. Well, let's hope that for Benny Gantz, the worst year of his life is over and he gets to become the defence minister and go back to the Kiria, to a building that he's very comfortable with and has a nice office, and the defence ministry is the defence minister, and, you know, he is in much more comfortable surroundings with people he knows how to work with well. Just moving on to another question. I know that you've been doing a lot of reporting about the ultra-Orthodox community and the coronavirus, and people who haven't seen some of the articles you've written recently, and I know you were in B'nai Brak today talking about that. I wonder if you could just share with us some of your reflections, because you wrote a very interesting article this week where you talked about how the rabbis that sort of lead a lot of the ultra-Orthodox communities have really got this one wrong, and in the way that they've handled the coronavirus, this could really be the end of their authority and could lead to some major changes in the ultra-Orthodox community and the model of how those lives are run. I wonder if you could just share some thoughts about that.
Well, I called this in a piece I wrote in the Haaretz, the biggest challenge to the ultra-Orthodox ethos since the Holocaust. And I think that some people may see that as an exaggeration, but we've seen over the last 70 years the ultra-Orthodoxy, after so many ultra-Orthodox Jews were slaughtered during the Holocaust, and in many ways they remained only tiny handfuls of survivor communities in Israel and in the US and in the UK after the war. And we've seen this incredible, exponential is a word that's being used a lot nowadays, but we have seen this exponential growth of ultra-Orthodox communities in Israel and in other parts of the diaspora. And with that, a growing sense of confidence and an ethos that this is a community which has to study Torah the whole time, because it's their duty to uphold that tradition, even though that tradition, there wasn't really a tradition of everyone studying Torah, that the way they tried to make it out to be. And for the last 70 years, the rabbi has said, we don't serve in the army, and we don't go out to work, and we don't go to university. We sit and learn Torah the whole time. And now that the most senior of the ultra-Orthodox rabbis, at least of the Lithuanians, the non-Hasidic Ashkenazi community, Rabbi Chaim Kanievsky, 3.5 weeks ago said, no, we're not going to shut down the schools like everyone else. We're going to carry on in Torah. Torah saves lives. There's nothing wrong with carrying and studying Torah in a time of plague and so on. And then just this week, he totally reversed that ruling and said that even prayers must from now on be held in private, and we don't have a minyan, the quorum of 10 people who pray together. Even that is something in these times. That's a massive reversal, and we're already seeing here in Israel that a very disproportionate number of people who have the virus and who are being hospitalized are from the ultra-Orthodox community, probably about three times their proportion of within the Israeli population. And we've seen, especially in the US and also partly in Britain, a large number of members of that community already succumbing and dying because of the virus. And that really has is shaking the community to the core. Nobody can predict how that will play out, but this really has basically said to them, you know, you've been saying that you study Torah, we study Torah, and that saves us. It currently isn't saving them, and this is a lot for them to have to swallow. And you're already hearing all kinds of explanations about what the message. This is a message from God in different ways, but it certainly is a challenge, and the community has already been challenged. Is already being challenged. There's a lot of question marks over whether the Haredi model of having an insular community in this day and age could be sustained. You know, we're seeing more people going out to work, more people going to university and college, more women trying to delay the age where they get married and have less children and so on. So these, you know, there's already been an erosion to the rabbinical authority in that sense, and now it's really out in the open, and it could have really far-reaching implications. Too early to predict what they will be.
They could speed it up. But on your sort of travels today, did you notice that the community was much more compliant with all the restrictions being put in by the government, and was much more following all the guidelines from the health ministry and beyond?
Totally. I mean, today in Bnei Brak, I think I saw the best behaved Israeli community that I've seen in recent weeks during the lockdown. And when you think about it, if there's one community who can abide by these kind of rules, it should be the Orthodox community, because they are a community who don't go out on Shabbat and holidays. You know, they don't drive and they don't travel. This is a community which are used to only eating certain prescribed foods. And this is a community which is used to keeping certain religious rules of hygiene and washing your hands at all kinds of times and so on and so forth. So if in anything, you could say that the rest of the Israeli society has been leading almost a Haredi lifestyle for the last 3 weeks, stuck in home and constantly washing your hands. Mm-hmm. So that really leads to the question, why is this only happening now? Because if the message had got through to the Haredi community at the same time it came through to the rest of Israeli society, then we wouldn't be seeing these very, very high levels of infection in Bnei Brak and other Haredi areas around the country. So the question is, why didn't the message go through? The answers are because of the rabbis, because of a sort of disconnect between Israeli mainstream and this community. Because they have television, they have radio, their mobile phones are blocked to the internet and to messaging apps and so on. And the question marks are, yeah, All this effort in keeping the community apart, has it not caused them really grievous harm right now?
Yeah, the result of isolation. Anshul, we'll leave it there, but thank you so much for joining us, and thank you all for listening.
It's always a pleasure to be with you, James.
Speak to you soon. Bye-bye.